Our forum tonight is South Africa, where are we and what ought we to do now? And the format for the night is for Norman Barth to provide us just with some very brief and basic background and from his experience maybe to lay out some of the options from various perspectives for us to chew on. And then Barbara Rossing is going to amplify what Norman has said by bringing in some other aspects of the situation in South Africa. And then we're just going to throw it open to everybody, because some of you may actually have an avocation and you're really following this issue and could help educate the rest of us about what you think. And then my role will be to moderate and then also perhaps to play the role of the person who asks questions about the moral dimensions of some of these issues. So with that introduction, I would like to turn things over to Norman so that he can get us started.
And that's just what I'm going to do. I'm going to rush very quickly some of the aspects of South Africa that I and my family experienced, having lived in Southern Africa for 7 years and 5 years in South Africa itself. I'm sure you all know that the Nationalist Party came into being in 1948 and then established a system of apartheid, separation, where they separated the races by their ethnic background, by color, really. Black, white, colored, mixture of black and white, and Asian or Indian. And they decided that you were one race or another by, first of all, maybe looking at you, but also looking into your background. I say that because I can recall a Finnish a gentleman who worked for the General Motors as the treasurer of General Motors. He was Finnish, but he was an American, but he was Finnish ancestry. His daughter had the blondest hair you've ever seen, and the whole family was, to our perception, white, except the South Africans decided to classify them as colored, because you see, the Finns originally came from way out there in Siberia and then came across, and so obviously they weren't white. Well, we finally took care of that, but I mean, that's how absurd they are in determining what race you belong to. Janet and my family and I were there from 66 to 68, and I was the consul, the principal officer at our consulate in Port Elizabeth, now closed. But it had the largest American holdings in the country were in my consular district. Phillips Carbon Black, General Motors, Goodyear Tire, Firestone, Ford, all had plants, assembly plants, and manufacturing plants there. And I was of the opinion at that time that the only way the black person was going to gain his political independence was to make South Africa dependent upon him economically. There were job restriction laws that only certain people, only white people, could do certain jobs. But as the economy grew, they had to make adjustments for that. For example, in Borg Warner in Uitenhage, a town just outside of PE, Port Elizabeth, they were making certain parts, components for the automobile industry. And to run a milling machine, you had to be white. But the demand for machinists was so great and could not be met by the white that they finally let black people start running the milling machines. But they couldn't put the stock in there. That had to be done by a white man, and then they could run the machine. But you see, the point was that the blacks became a necessity in the economy, and I was sure that was going to bring about their political independence. Our second tour there was in Pretoria from 77 to 80, And upon return, Soweto had just happened a year before we returned, and I observed, and my family observed, that not much really had changed. Quite the contrary. Apartheid laws were if anything, more severe. And that changed my view completely. Rather than investing our last penny in South Africa, I became convinced, at least economically and now morally, that we should restrict our investments in South Africa. And so I've become an advocate of divestment, whereas at one time I was an advocate of investment. Huh? But this is part of the South African picture. I am, just to go along with a few other points that Grant made, being in the embassy, I think that we could do more than we are doing. But maybe before I talk about that, let me say that South Africa produces certain minerals which are produced only in South Africa. One of them, I think it's titanium. We need 900 pounds of that particular mineral in order to make one jet engine. That means one jet engine for Boeing, one jet engine for McDonnell Douglas or any of our aircraft. So it's essential, and you can only almost get it in South Africa. There are other minerals that they also have that are essential to, we feel, to our industrial capacity. Then I was going to, what was the point I was going to make there? Oh, the embassy. What can we do that I think, what should we be doing that we're not doing now? As a former State Department employee, I know the composition of our embassy in Pretoria, and I think we ought to reduce the size of our embassy by removing the agricultural attaché, the commercial attaché, the labor attaché, the military attachés, the naval attaché, the Air Force attaché, and reduce the staff down to a lot smaller size than it is. Also, South Africa, when I was there, and it still is the regional headquarters for our activities in Southern Africa. We have, for example, a regional finance officer, a personnel officer, a medical officer, all stationed there to go out to places like Lusaka in Zambia, to Madagascar, Maputo, to go over to Mozambique, and so on. Madagascar, the capital is not Maputo. I'm sorry, that's Mozambique. But we were the regional center. I suggested, that even when I was there, that we move those regional people up to Harare in Rhodesia. That would strengthen our position there, would provide whatever income that an embassy of that size could produce for the economy. That we not only then reduce the embassy by that, but that we close our Cape Town, maybe, and our Durban consulates general, and just have one consulate general in Johannesburg. Most of the people who get visas are white, admittedly. There are others who get them. But you can get visas nowadays by mail. Personal appearance is no longer necessary under the law, and so it wouldn't be too difficult. But I stopped there. I think I've thrown out enough controversy
That was great.
Talk.
Barbara, would you like to amplify? What would you like to say to amplify that?
Well, I want to just talk about two areas briefly that I think are important to consider as church people. First of all, the situation in Namibia, and then second of all, more generally, the role of churches in South Africa and here. I think what's happened in Namibia in this past year is tremendously important for those of us here who have been working for Independence for Namibia for a long time, and also people in Namibia, and that we really need to continue to keep the heat on South Africa. I guess I'm sure that we all greeted with hope and great anticipation the announcement that South Africa, having been probably surrounded militarily, most people agree that's what happened, finally agreed to go to the bargaining table and give independence to Namibia. And then the massacres of April 1st through 10th in there were very distressing. Lots of debate about what happened. I guess it sounds to me from people like the Namibia Communications Center in London, the Namibia Concerns Committee in Denver, and other organizations, that the U.S. media really reported that inaccurately, in the sense that we got told the story that South Africa would like us to hear, and that it wasn't the SWAPO people that fired first, that they actually thought they were going to be able to surrender themselves to UN forces and were horrified to be greeted instead by South African troops. Anyway, so Namibian independence has gotten off to a very bad start, with at least 300 Namibians killed needlessly by South African troops. And we need to hope and pray and work to see that situation get back on track, and I think churches have a role there. The Lutherans have sent Raleigh Deffenbaugh, for example, to be an advisor to the Namibian bishops on legal affairs, and I think that's really important. I think we need to lobby our government to make sure that our contribution to the United Nations untagged force is what they're called, goes through. We need to make sure enough United Nations people are on site to make South Africa's thugs, the Kufuor organization and South African troops be confined to bases. I think there's a very important role right now for United States Christians to play in pressuring our government and the United Nations on this whole Namibia situation, that we can't let up the pressure. Elections are scheduled for next November, and then the transition takes place, and there's still a lot more points at which things could go wrong, and we already saw in April sort of the worst case scenario. Then to get to the role of churches, a lot of people would argue that in South Africa today, that the only two sort of hopeful forces that really could affect meaningful change at this point are the labor unions and the churches. And from my visits in South Africa, which have not been a period of residence like Norm's, I've mainly visited and contacted with church people and have been really impressed with the people I've met from a number of different denominations and perspectives. But I think that we really need to support people in their struggle there. Independence or a change is not going to come in South Africa at our instigation. It has to come from the people of South Africa themselves, and I think they're willing to really work for that, and there's a lot of people doing that. Our support can take the form of prayer. I shared that in the Kairos document session. I think that's the most important thing we can do. That's what South Africans are asking us for. The churches are doing some really exciting things. We need to pray for them in those struggles and support them. Then I guess I would say, though, the one action that it seems like is an important one at this time for Americans who are many miles away from South Africa, and we're not obviously going to call the shots there, but the one way that we can bring pressure for peaceful change rather than a violent solution there is economic pressure and the whole area of divestment and sanctions. Divestment on the form of pressuring U.S. companies to get out of South Africa because of believing that they do contribute to maintain the status quo there. And then economic sanctions, even more importantly, pressuring our government to apply stricter sanctions against South Africa to force them to the bargaining table. I mean, I don't think we want to have any kind of punitive the sanctions have one purpose, and that is to bring about pressuring them into having a constitutional convention or whatever to negotiate with, to release Nelson Mandela and negotiate a new constitution. Church leaders in South Africa are calling us to that. It started years ago and has intensified in recent years with a number of meetings in Southern Africa, the Lusaka Declaration. I think it's obvious that the churches in South Africa that represent the masses of people really are calling for us as American Christians to apply those kinds of pressures and we need to get moving on that. So those are a couple things.
As a outsider who is not a Lutheran, I'm just curious, Barbara, has the Lutheran Church itself divested its holdings in South Africa, and have all the synods followed likewise?
Yeah, that's a tough one right now. No, it's been, I think, more than 10 years. No, maybe, well, at least for the American Lutheran Church, which I know best, one of the predecessor bodies, since they first started voting to tell the pension board to divest the pension monies, our future, you know, retirement checks, from U.S. companies who are doing business in South Africa. And in the LCA, a similar thing, the pension boards drag their feet. But in the ALC anyway, they were moving that direction slowly. I have a relative who was on the pension board who resigned over this whole thing. They would take the route of voting shareholder resolutions in the Xerox company, for example. That was probably the most famous one. And then when the Xerox didn't get out of South Africa, they sold those shares, so slowly. But now I hear in the new ELCA, for example, they've actually bought more stock. Their holdings in South African companies with dealings in South Africa has actually gone up in this past year. So no, I think the pension members need to really pressure our church on that. The pension board, their argument is that we as trustees are legally liable if anything. If our returns go down on this money, a pension member could sue them personally and win in court because of that whole, you know, prudent man law and all that. So in the ELCA now, there is an organization called Pension Members for Justice that's sole purpose is to work for divestment.
So there's a very concrete thing that members of Lutheran congregations can do here in that area. Let me ask you another thing, Norm, about the Sullivan Principles. A lot of people have probably heard about that, and that's an option that some companies say that we ought to stay there because we're following the Sullivan Principles, and that was an agreed-upon thing, and that's the way to work, and that's some of what your earlier position was, but I'm not sure if everybody knows about those Sullivan Principles.
Yeah, the Sullivan Principles are a set of, 15, I think, or thereabouts, principles designed by Leon Sullivan, a black pastor from Philadelphia. And they were to be the guidelines for American companies to follow in South Africa. They required, for example, that not only would you pay the fellow a living wage, but you would also be concerned with your employees' life in the community. That is, you would think about maybe helping construct a school or a nursery for his children or other aspects, or give him additional training. That was very fine. My own view and the embassy, the U.S. Embassy, was to kind of monitor this along with this firm Little, I forget what it is, full firm, D.A. Little or something, and see if these were being followed. I found the Sullivan Principles really to be cosmetic more than actually of any great value in raising up the standard of living for non-white employees. And I found it also disquieting that one important American employer did not sign the Sullivan Principles nor adhere to them, primarily the United States government. And when I brought that to the attention of Washington, they said, well, we can't possibly, you know, provide housing for local employees in South Africa, then we'd have to do that same thing in Peru and in Thailand and other places, because we can't pass a policy that's so specific for one country. That was their way out. But Sullivan Act now, or the Sullivan Principles, of course, as American firms are leaving, really are an interesting piece of history.
And Sullivan himself has refuted them.
Right, I understand. There's a deadline.
Okay.
Another question, I'm not a Lutheran. Does Lutheran World Relief work in South Africa in some ways? Is there a way you can channel funds there to help?
Sure. And we do. We work through ELCSA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in South Africa, as well as the South African Council of Churches. In Namibia, we work through the Namibian Council of Churches. But we do so on the basis of five policies or principles that our board passed. First of all, we will not support any program which has any South African money in it, either at the national level or at the provincial level or even at the town level.
South African government money.
South African government money, yeah. If the South African government at any level is involved in the project, we won't touch it. Mm-hmm. Secondly, the project has to be approved or meet the okay of ELCSA or the Council of Churches. If it doesn't get their blessing, we don't do it. And there are five, and I probably won't be able to remember them. Another one is that it can in no way, philosophically or in fact, advance apartheid or the principles of apartheid. The project must be available for all races, black, brown, white, or anything. And I think the fifth one is, and it just slipped my mind now, it must be generated by the people of the community. So we have, for example, at Crossroads in Cape Town, we gave $75,000 there. We've sent quilts there made by Lutheran church women down when there was a rather large storm. I forget what the principles were exactly. Out in Tabanachu.
Tabanachu in Unferbach, yeah.
Yeah.
With Phil Knutson, that project?
That's right. Yeah. We supported that project, I think around 200 and some thousand dollars, huh? So we do work in South Africa.
Now that's an interesting one, Norm. I'd like to. Okay, now that would be an example of this is a resettlement camp, which is Unferbach just developed over the last like 5 or 6 years, where the South African government has dumped. When I was there, it was 200,000 people. It's probably up to 500,000 now. Just dump these people out in the middle of the desert with nothing. But there you've got the question of when you start projects and help them, are you enabling the South African government in this dumping? Have you struggled with that one in LDR?
Yes, but there again, if the people on the ground say they want it, in this case, Jim Knutson's son, and the ELCSA, they say this is what we should be doing, then we support it. If it didn't get their blessing, we wouldn't have. Mm-hmm. And in that case, what we're doing is trying to establish a water project, quite honestly, and a sewage system, a latrine system in that area.
What's a typical divestment of a company closing down or selling out, or what happens?
Well, what's happening, as far as I've read it, is that very often South African interests buy it, Japanese might buy it, and things like that. I might say that, and I'm sure my wife could confirm this, that while we were down there, we never, never, never met a black South African who was opposed to divestment. Never. And I used to ask them pointedly. They said, look, we're hungry 5 days a week already, so we're going to be hungry for two more? Big deal. But if we can cast off apartheid and get political freedom and the franchise, it would be worth those.
But the factory or whatever does continue to operate the same way, only the United States or these companies that say we want no part of it.
That's
a message.
Yeah.
And the value of that, I mean, I think I would say the same thing. We even met, when we talked to we visited 3M, that was the main company we visited because the ALC at that time held a lot of 3M stock and it was a Minnesota company and stuff. And we ate in our integrated lunchroom, but when we could get the blacks sort of alone and asked the 3M employees, should the church divest? Should the church divest from 3M? Should 3M get out of South Africa? All those things, they said, yeah. I mean, they wanted to lose a job, basically. And I think that, yeah, you can say the company gets bought by another interest, Japanese or whatever, but the psychological, well, it's not just psychologically, the symbolic meaning of United States contact means for South Africa that it's part of the civilized world, that it can call itself a Western country, that it ties with America, means so much to them symbolically and everything, that, I mean, the South Africa, it's not the same to have a firm owned by the Japanese. Obviously, Japan should be doing the same thing. They should have their own divestment movement. They should be pressuring. But to lose American support is very important, because there's still a perception in South Africa that America is a country that really matters. And that to have American companies there is really, really important to the people.
Let me ask you another factual question. Don't the Dutch and the British have much larger investments in South Africa than the Americans?
The British probably do.
The British.
I'm not sure about the Dutch. If I might just pick up a thing that Barbara said.
Then we should probably open it up and get everybody.
Yeah, the Japanese, you might be interested in knowing this little refinement. The Japanese are honorary whites.
Oh, yeah, honorary whites.
Isn't that nice? Mm-hmm. Honorary whites. So they can go into a hotel and get all the benefits that you might get. Huh? So they've taken that. And Barbara also reminded me about the Sullivan Act and lunchrooms. Sullivan Act says everybody eats together, huh? Regardless of race. And these firms got around that by saying that lunchroom is for managers, huh? And this is for people on the working on the floor, huh? Or another way they got away is they set up the price so high in that lunchroom, you know, like $5 for a hamburger, and over here it's only 35 cents. Well, a black man isn't going to go into that one, you see. I mean, but they never said you can't go in there. All you have to do is pay $5 or some exorbitant price that a white manager could manage, but a guy on the line couldn't. And lots of clever way, and that's why I say that Sullivan principles were interesting for them.
I imagine the investments there are immensely lucrative since they have slave labor. That's why our pension funds say they have to stay there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that really isn't true, early.
But isn't that what they say?
Well, that may be, but yeah. I mean, there's a firm in Boston that will get you investments that will return equally as well as the investments that they are invested in. I mean,
No, the argument with the most recent investing in a company that was doing business in South Africa was that in that segment of the market, I think it was a kind of pharmaceuticals or something, they could find literally no companies that weren't doing business in South Africa. And their argument was you can't have a pension portfolio and leave out this whole segment of the market, this whole product line. That's too risky. Now, of course, we could always argue, but you do leave out tobacco and alcohol. The Lutheran Church has always had a policy that they will not invest in tobacco companies, alcohol companies, gambling companies, whatever. So those segments of the market are okay to leave out, even if the return would be higher. We're not going to invest the pension holders' money in a tobacco or alcohol company. So, I mean, I guess the question would be, well, why do we have to hold a pharmaceutical if none is available that isn't doing business in South Africa?
And what is the response to that? That's interesting. Have they given a response to that?
No.
Okay.
Of the companies that they choose, I've had my share. Somebody else.
Well, I was going to raise the point. From the news media, I have had the impression, at least they have featured situations where one would think that maybe of the whites there is an increasing number who are beginning to say apartheid is wrong, let's change. What's your opinion of this? Is this really increasing significantly, or are these very isolated cases of whites supporting a change significantly?
Well, I guess, I mean, I would say that of the white people I met, you know, they were wonderful. They do believe in change, but, and so, I mean, they're not bad people in any sense. But if you look at the way they're voting, that's, you know, what you have to go by. They're voting now more conservatively than they did before. And so, you know, as even a new party is set up that is trying to move towards equality, you know, of the white people who can vote, nobody's voting there. You know, fewer people are voting in that camp, and more are voting even to the right of the Nationalist Party. So it's sad. I mean, it's, and you know, we can be glad we're not South African whites. It must be really painful. I'm sure it's very difficult. And they struggle with faith issues too. But when it comes to going to the ballot box, they can't seem to, you know, get themselves to start voting for a more just party. I don't know. I mean, that's.
I would just add to that by saying that I was last there in 86 on my way to Swaziland and to Mozambique. And I stopped to see friends of ours in South Africa, and these are Afrikaners. And by the way, I think you'll find maybe more liberals among the Afrikaner group than you will among the English-speaking group, but that's neither here nor there. These were young people, 35 or 6, in the mid-30s any, with young children. They are deeply concerned by the trend that Barbara speaks of. They fear more the far right than they do the far left. The far left, if you want to put it there, you, the ANC. They feel their fear of that almost neo-Nazi party that you've seen on television, a coup by the military. They realize, and I, even before we left in 1980, another South African, Afrikaner friend, I can hear her saying to her 80-some-year-old father, but dad, or grandfather, because they have children, you know, we've got to change. You say you will fight to the last drop of blood, but how about our son, or your grandson? Should he? You know? And Barbara's right. There are many whites, I think, are really torn by this thing. And unfortunately, it's the radical fringe elements that too often carry the day because they are so ideological in their approach.
We, you don't have to just ask us questions, too. I think we'd like to hear your opinions.
Absolutely.
Robert.
When you say that the whites have a struggle like everybody else in going to the ballot box, aren't they just simply looking after their own interests in the same way as anyone who contributes to the pension scheme is looking after their own interests?
Yeah, I think so, but I think many of them are seeing their interest as being something other than solely a white franchise. I once tried to sell some newspapers on an op-ed piece, which I titled A Political Halfway House. I think, you're going to jump on me when I say this, I think those who advocate, even in this country, one man, one vote, are just on that fringe element also that I speak of.
Because the women have to be included.
Well, hey, if you want to do that. One person, one vote, whatever you want to call it. It's not realistic. Even in our own country, early on, we gave a limited franchise. You had to have a certain degree of education, or you had to pay a certain amount of taxes in order to vote. Why I suggested in this piece, why can't we say that all people in South Africa, regardless of race or gender, could vote if they had a high school education to start out with, and let then you have that kind of thing. And then you set about educating the people, educating the non-white people, so that you lift the educational level of everybody and you eventually get everybody to vote. When we were there, the South African government spent something like $500, I think, on a white child's education. They provided all the books free and everything else. A colored child, they spent something like $175. These figures may not be right, but the point is, and the child had to pay half the book fees. On a black child, and this figure is right, $35. And they paid all the book fees.
The child paid the book fee, you bet. I mean, you know, that's ridiculous. So rather than push them to where they let everybody vote, why not say, hey, why don't we do this over a graduated period of time with a rising standard if you want, huh?
Because, oh, Norm, I can't agree with that, I don't think.
Okay.
I would, because I think that's what, well, first of all, I think those elections would be boycotted by most blacks. I think that's what the new Constitution, at least whites would say, that's what they're moving towards. You know, they say, okay, you know, the 1984 Constitution, now we've got two new houses of parliament that for so-called colored people and so-called Asians, and in so many years, some blacks will get to vote too, you know, probably the urban blacks or something. I mean, they whites see themselves as gradually moving along those lines. But I don't think blacks would agree. I guess we were there just after the new Constitution came in 1984, and it was really interesting to see, it was tragic to see how excited whites were about this. Look, we're reforming, we're moving, we're going somewhere because we've got these two new houses of parliament and we're on our way towards reform. And how blacks would tell you, this new constitution is our death knell. We will never see the vote in South Africa. That new constitution split people more than you can imagine. And I think that blacks would say that your proposal would be unacceptable I just think they would, but...
Well, you're probably right, but the point is
that... My feeling is, Norm, your suggestion might have worked 25 years ago. I think it's too late now. Well, I think they've waited so long, they're not going to fool around with this. Didn't the coloreds even boycott the parliament?
And Asians. Yeah.
And the Asians?
I mean, it's going to be a lot longer.
Yeah.
They're just not willing to just get a little piece of the pie anymore. They want the whole thing. And it's a shame that they haven't been working for the last, you know, for a long time towards something. I think it's too late for that.
Well,
my opinion.
Sure.
How many black African college students are there in the United States? Not many.
I have no idea.
Black, of all the African nations?
Same from Namibia.
South Africa. There, I think the Lutheran Church is sponsoring two Namibian students at every Lutheran school.
Well, it's approximately 50.
But then there would be many more sponsored by the United Nations,
right.
Also, of Namibians.
Because with South America, and Jesuit colleges in Central America, that was one stimulation for change. And if the college students can get educated, then they can go back and educate their own countrymen. And I think that's one of the problems that happened in China, too, that the students came to the United States, learned democracy, and went back and infiltrated their own country. So I think the change could happen sooner than 25 years. Or I wouldn't give up hope. It is grim.
I can give one example from my own congregation where a family took in a white South African girl on a foreign exchange project, and she couldn't take it, but she was in school, in an integrated classroom, and after 2 months left and returned to South Africa.
Mm-hmm. But if the blacks came and studied and went back and educated their own people.
I think it's really important to remember. I mean, I would agree with you. I think we need to think and dream with South Africans and here in our country for every possible thing that could bring about nonviolent change. But we've got to remember, we're dealing with a reign of terror. South Africa is, I mean, they are in some senses one of the most terrorist nations in the world. They don't stop at blowing up. They'll go into Mozambique and blow up stuff. They'll go into Angola. I mean, they'll do almost anything. If people go, I mean, there are hundreds of thousands in prison. There have been reform efforts all through the years. Blacks have really tried to rise up, and those people are imprisoned for life. I mean, the stakes are really high here. This is definitely a reign of terror, I would say. They paint themselves as a civilized country, and yet, so many of the trappings, I mean, it's obvious it's a police state, and there aren't a lot of options for people who want to bring about change. So for a black I mean, we saw it in China. It would be a similar kind of situation.
Well, the divestment is real important, but also the positive implements of change.
No, I would really agree with you. Yes, I agree.
I would agree with you about educating, but I wouldn't limit it only to the blacks. I think what was done must be done with the whites as well. I mean, education is two-sided. And if that had been successful, you would have had a young lady who said, hey, this is ridiculous what we're doing down here. Well, and I know some that have been.
Well, that's what happened in Central America when the wealthy families, their children, were educated by the Jesuits and learned what the other side is.
Sure.
It was interesting, the last Lutheran World Federation, the issue brought up, and there were 99 countries represented, and they forbade the two larger white churches' membership in the LWF anymore. And their pastors wept. They always ask for more time. And I, you know, I wouldn't know what it's like to be in their shoes. But this group of people from across the globe said this is not, cannot continue. So these churches now, just like the Dutch Reformed, are out of connection with their brothers and sisters. And they hurt. I wept with the pastors because, you know, to be white in a world like that, it's tantamount to suicide, I suppose.
So there are some Lutheran churches in South Africa that are for whites only. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
Yes, I think the only way they can. I was invited by one of the pastors there to come and join him some years ago, and he's a blatant racist, but doesn't think of it that way, you know. I mean, he's a nice guy, he's from California. But I say it becomes demonic. And, well, like when I was a young pastor, I remember St. Paul, there was a ritzy church that had membership sold and only one pew in the back for visitors. And they investigated a person's income before they admitted him. This man was turned down. On Monday, he was kind of disappointed, and he left. One of his friends said, why are you so tragically depressed? He said, I applied and didn't get in. He said, you have good fellowship. He said, Jesus tried to it, never broke in. I think that's the horror of this type of thing. It's demonic.
What, I want to get back to this thing about educating white South Africans. Does the Lutheran Church bring white South African students here for education as well as black South Africans?
We're bringing Namibians.
Namibians,
yeah, white black, Namibians. Black and colored. Yeah.
Black and colored. Because what I'm hearing is that we have this strange situation in which there are something like 26 million blacks and 6 million whites. Is that about
a little less than that in whites?
Okay, but they seem to hold all the cards. I mean, wouldn't it make sense to try to get the children of the power structure there into the United States to see that it is possible for races to live together and have them go back? And
well, okay, then maybe we need to shift our focus to talking about our country here. Because you were talking coffee break. I mean, do we seriously believe that we are doing such a good job of being an interracial country here that someone's going to get converted by visiting, say, an American city to seeing how well we are doing at an integrated society, that it's going to convert a South African to believing it's possible? I mean, I don't think we can claim to be a witness in this respect. And then the other question is that how you convert the powerful? Are people in power ever willingly going to give up power? And are the white South Africans really the ones we need to invest in? I mean, I think political analysis would... Well, I don't know. I just don't think that people in power are likely to give it up by seeing how wonderful things are in America and how we're going to live together that way. But maybe you have a different view of our country from what I do.
Well, they're just there isn't time to educate.
Nor money.
People. I mean, so the ELCA has two Namibian students, black Namibian students in all its colleges, two. Times 26, let's say. I mean, that's how many? 26 million?
Blacks.
Yeah?
People always talk to me about.
There isn't time to.
In Namibia, it's only 1 million people. That's a pretty small country, but yeah.
But everybody talks to me about time. As I see it, the Nationalist Party has been in power for 41 years. What's all this stuff about time? I mean,
well, it could go on for another 41.
You bet. Right. I mean that it's going to be changed overnight. I'm raising the question, I guess.
I think it's the fear of the bloodbath. I mean, it's just so volatile and so. And looking at ways to, prevent that or whatever. I was curious more about talking about the sort of the fear of the right and all of that. We had a woman here on staff who was a foreign exchange student in high school. Now she's 35 or so. She isn't here anymore, but lived with a white, was it an Afrikaner family?
I didn't meet her in here.
Jeanette.
Oh, Jeanette, yeah. No, lived with an English-speaking family.
Yeah. They came to Holden, and there was quite a heated debate about that at a session similar to this. And then last winter, they sent a video that they wanted the whole village to watch. They felt we were pretty biased in our opinion in that. And anyway, this video was just incredible. I mean, we were just amazed at the propaganda. That was so. Is there anybody here who saw it? Paul, were you there?
I couldn't hear what you were saying.
It was a video. It was very flashy about showing the progress that supposedly been made in Africa. I mean, blacks. I mean, some people are feeding them. I mean, that apathy about voting is really.
That's what I wanted to ask. In America, we have such tremendous apathy among the voting population. What is the percentage of involvement at the grassroots level in the whites in South Africa? Are they involved or are they uninformed and just go about their daily tasks like thousands of Americans do?
No, I can't remember any longer. But I'm of the opinion, if I could recall, that it's up around 70%, 65, 70%. But then you're only talking about, that 3.5 million whites or 4 million right. whites, and then you get only 60 or 70% of those people voting. So, it's not a very, obviously it's not representative of the population, but
plus, the Nationalist Party has been in control for so long.
Yeah.
They haven't had any opposition, so everybody just sort of goes along and doesn't really expect to make much difference with their vote.
And their political process is so different.
Well, it's parliamentarian.
Right.
I want to get back to this question of, I guess, your question, Grant, of what's the rush, sort of, or whatever. Because I think the rush is, as Jackie says, the bloodbath. I mean, even Bishop Tutu, for example, who is so hated by white South Africans, now is viewed by many blacks, I don't know whether to say most or not, but by many, as too moderate, that he invested too much hope in the possibility of nonviolent change, and look what's happened, nothing. And there's a growing sense of hopelessness among young blacks that the only possible solution is, to blow everything up. Because nothing else accomplishes anything. So you organize a new group that's 100% committed to nonviolence, like the United Democratic Front. And what happens? Your leaders are arrested. So you try another organization. So you try to invest in nonviolence. So you try to go constructively. And what happens? Everyone's rounded up. And they're sentenced to the death penalty. Not that they actually contributed to violence themselves, but that they helped create a violent climate. And those people, 16, 17? They're scheduled for execution. I mean, there's so much injustice in South Africa that when you see that kind of thing year after year after year, young blacks are giving up on any hope for peaceful change. And I think we, as God's people, if we want to support Jesus' way, we have to be working fast and furious to try to keep options open for black South Africans so that they don't turn in violence themselves against the violence that has been inflicted on them for so many years. I mean, I believe in peaceful, nonviolent change. But, I would say I'm pretty close to being a pacifist. But what I see a lot of among us and whites in South Africa is a sort of passivism, you know, where we just sit passively and watch the process inevitably move towards, you know, do we really want to see South Africa become another Beirut? I mean, do we really want to write off this country that's full of people who we love? And that's what we're doing if we're not working with every shred of our being to bring about pressure for nonviolent change. And the people that need the pressure are the whites who are in power.
But Barbara, it sounds to me, really, that you're not a pacifist. And I'm really surprised by what you're saying. Because I keep hearing you talking about violence as what's going to happen. And you almost seem to support this group that are going to bring about the violent thing. South Africa, in my view, and I was first there in 66, and people were telling me it was going to be, a new country in 10 years. 23 years have gone by. When I left South Africa in 80, people in the embassy said, 5 years, it's going to be over. And it'll be a multiracial country. When I walked into the ambassador's office on September the 27th, 1977, he said, Norm, by the end of the calendar year, Namibia will be independent. Mm. And I went to Namibia and rented a site for the embassy. I rented 10 houses and apartments because we were going to move in. And we paid some $35,000 to $40,000 for 3 years and never occupied any of them. I don't think there's going to be a bloodbath in South Africa. I'm sorry. I just know the South African Army and the Defense Force, and they can take on the entire continent of Africa, south of the Sahara, and beat them.
But let's then...
And therefore I really don't see that there's going to be this kind of bloodbath. But then unless they're absolutely foolish, because the blood is going to be black blood.
They're in the townships. Oh yeah, it is going to be black blood, absolutely. Yeah.
Well then let's talk... Talk about, why are we pussyfooting around here, folks? I mean, look, the United States had a revolution against the democratic government because we simply put on some taxes and we didn't get some representation. And we think our revolution is this wonderful thing that brought about truth and justice in the American way. And we're very proud, a lot of us, of our forefathers, fathers, pastors, who supported the revolution. We think of them as good people as opposed to those who were not in favor of the revolution. Why isn't the church out there training a guerrilla force to, in Africa to try to really meet this thing? Why don't we train people to... to bring about justice? Couldn't you possibly use just war theory in this case and have the churches, as they used to do in ancient times? William the Conqueror, before he conquered England, remember, went to the Pope to try to get approval to see if it was a just war that was being engaged in. And after the conquest, everybody who killed had to do penance for a year, couldn't receive communion, even though it was a just war. I mean, sometimes I wonder, aren't we pussy? What's this sort of, this kind of purity that we're talking about in the church? I mean...
Well, back then, the church made clear statements about economics and directed world economics.
But if the situation is so bad...
Well, in all seriousness, Grant, I do think, I don't think the church needs to train an army because there already are groups that are working. In Namibia, it was SWAPO, and South Africa, it's the African National Congress. I think... The church leaders ought to make darn sure that, we ought to be pressuring our government and the South African government to meet and sit down with those people. There's all kinds of options, I guess that's what I'm trying to say, that are still open, but we're not even bringing about that pressure. I guess that's what I don't understand, is why we don't even do what we can do peacefully. The ANC, Well, I don't know. I just think there ought to be a lot more contact there. There's all kinds of things. No, we don't have to be training armies yet. There's plenty of options.
Okay. Just want to bring that up.
But I would say, all right, here's one. The World Council of Churches gave a little money, and folks, it really was a little money, from the Program to Combat Racism, which is a fund that most of the U.S. churches never contribute to. They gave a little bit of money to some of the peaceful outreach efforts of the African National Congress, which there are. I mean, it was the humanitarian stuff, like education and stuff like that. And look at the bad press they got, you know, from Reader's Digest and everybody else. And, you know, you say you believe in peaceful change in South Africa, but you won't even let the World Council of Churches take somebody else's money, it wasn't U.S. money generally, and give it to peaceful aspects of the one movement that really is working, you know, that is the authentic liberation movement. I mean, that got so much bad press in this country, it was really something, so.
Let me ask you another question for you out there. Does this come up in your congregations? Is this something that gets talked about? Is it something that gets talked about on campuses? Things are going on? Or is this something that we talk about that's kind of off here? Maybe we feel about it, but nothing's really going on.
On campuses, maybe.
In 1 minute or
not in the church I'm at. I'm not talked about. In Oregon, in Florence, there's a pastor who spent 2 years teaching in the seminary.
In
where?
Where?
In Florence. One of the...
Yeah, but where did he teach?
In Namibia, in the seminary.
We have adult forums in ours, and we bring up a lot of issues like this. And I think we have a pretty good group that comes to all of them.
Let's bring it back again to Barbara's earlier point. I mean, do things come up about the pension fund? We had a big fight in the Episcopal Church about this very same issue.
What did you come up?
To tell you the truth, the last I heard was they did begin the process of disinvesting because dioceses were refusing to pay their money. They were keeping it in escrow.
To students at California Lutheran University led a campaign for the university to divest, which was successful.
Another thing that we did here at Holden Village that was, I think, helped a little drop in the bucket was we worked all last year writing letters for the release of a South African pastor who was in prison, the Lutheran pastor, Molefe Tsele, and we can continue to write on behalf of prisoners through Amnesty International and organizations like that. I mean, so many people are in prison unjustly, it's hard to know where to start, but you just get a name and you start.
I think particularly in Namibia, as Lutheran universities and colleges, we could be organizing faculty to go to Namibia and to be involved in education there as independence comes. I'm wondering, Norm, do you think there will be elections in November, or do you think South Africa now has such control of what's happening there that it would be another long cycle of their control?
Well, I think there will be elections. Friends I have who are still in the State Department, one of them heads the Interdepartmental Task Force on Namibia, Fred Fisher, who happens to be a Lutheran. He fully expects there to be elections. He's in Namibia now. But you know, one of the problems I have is in November at the LWR board meeting, I called for the Lutheran Church to raise $10 million over the next 3 years for work in Namibia and to provide that money to LWF because they may be operational in Namibia. And I asked for $3 million to advance the Arias Peace Plan in Central America, $13 million over 3 years. There are in the ELCA and the LCMS Church roughly 8-9 million, you can even say 10 if you want to play with numbers. You know, that's 33 cents per person for a year. And it's nothing. And the churches, neither one of them, has done anything to start raising that money. I'm afraid, you know, Barbara, that, and I've been part of the Namibia Network, we're so ready to write letters, but I'm afraid we're not ready to reach into our pocket and plunk the money down on the table. It sure is, you know. You can talk from now until Christmas, but when you ask for some money, boy, then you start looking for people.
I think there's another thing we're not quite ready to do, and this comes very close to home, and I won't tell the whole story, except to say that, yes, we want to, many of us would like to go in and help with the transition, but we aren't prepared to be told what to do. We want to advise the Namibians how to set up a higher education system. And at the ELCA Peace and Justice Education Task Force in April, Herman Deers of Wartburg College had a plan ready to go. And we advised him, and he was well aware of this too. Herman is a very sensitive person about these things. We advised him on information that had been received from various church leaders in Namibia, that we would only act when the Namibians were ready for us to do so. And I say this out of a lot of concern about the transition that's taking place in Namibia, because I think whenever you move from a regime that is colonial and has been, and they all are, oppressive, you have so many psychological factors to deal with that it becomes tremendously complicated. And that's why black-on-black violence is a problem. It's why we can't sit here and decide whether it's going to be a violent or a non-violent transition. We have no control over those factors, even though we can put pressure, we can apply some pressure toward a non-violent resolution, because the seeds have been sown that are very difficult, you know, in, we have to reap some of those seeds that have been sown. That's the only way I can put it. We have to deal with some of the, we've been talking about consequences, you know, if it's an evil that's been sown, we have to deal with some of those consequences.
It's after 10. What I'd like to do is provide an opportunity for those who would like to get up and leave to have the opportunity to do so. Those who would like to remain and continue the discussion for a little bit, tell Laura and Barbara and get up myself.
There's Kaplan at 10:15.
And then, oh yeah, 10:15. So we've got, oh, yeah, we've got 10 more minutes here at most. So
thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.